Plain Tales from the Ranch. A panorama of British India, recorded by some of those who lived in it. Program 3. Mem Sahib.
Rudyard Kipling immortalized the Mem Sahibs, the wives and daughters of the Raj, in fictional figures like Mrs. Hawkesby and the Venus Anno Domini. An immortality they could sometimes have done without, for it was firmly based on the male-dominated viewpoint which dominated the Raj itself. It wasn't only outsiders who were critical of the Mem Sahib.
I never quite made up my mind as to why she came to occupy the position she did. Now, most of them started off as perfectly reasonable, decent English girls. They came out to India as part of what was known as the fishing fleet, the P&O, which arrived in India about the end of October, with a selection of nieces and cousins and so on, of people already in India, in the hope that they would be able to find a husband. Many of them, in the course of time, developed into really what I can only describe as the most awful old harridans. And I think they were very largely responsible for the breakup of relations between the British and the Indians. You see, in the early days, British officers spent much more time with Indians, got to know them better. Whereas once the English woman started to arrive in India, she expected her husband to spend his spare time with her. This is probably a slightly unfair point of view, but I think there's a great deal of truth in it.
And the women remained, I think, always apart. I think they remembered episodes like the mutiny much more than the men did. And they influenced, to a certain extent, the behavior and the feelings of menfolk.
But when you start taking a Mem Sahib's eye view of India, the perspectives begin to shift.
The sort of mythical picture of the British Mem Sahib, which I think was started by Kipling and has lived in the annals ever since, of course, there was a certain amount of truth in it. But it was a generalization, and I hate generalizations myself. British women in India were like British women anywhere else. They were a lot of individuals. I think there were certain attitudes which you took up, perhaps, from all the others, such as you don't mingle with Indians too much. You remember that you're British. But you may or may not have fitted into it inside yourself.
India was never a country to be trifled with. It demanded a lot of men, and in some ways, even more of women. And it often got what it demanded.
Well, Mother was born in a tent in the NWFP, or Northwest Frontier Province. She used to tell me of how Granny used to trek, generally in a bullock wagon with these wet towels tied round her head.
A friend of mine who lived in tents said she suffered most from jackals in her bathroom at night, which were rather tiring and sort of frightening when her husband was away on tour.
Another bungalow we went to one night, I sent the children to bed and an awful smell, and it turned out the whole ceiling was full of bats, and we had to have the tents put up and move out because of all the droppings on the mosquito nets and that sort of thing was a bit trying at times.
So we lived simply and had a very happy time. The camps were easy, except the fact when one was in a little hill valley, there'd be scorpions. And one of my duties was, when the tents were erected, to turn over every stone all round each tent to see how many scorpions I could kill from underneath before they got into our slippers or into our beds. Spiders didn't affect me very much. I didn't mind anything else except centipedes. I didn't like these huge centipedes. And especially when we hadn't got camp beds and were lying on the ground and a centipede would crawl over you, that I hated more than anything. Of course, in the hills, we always sat up round the campfire. And one of the delights would be to see these flying squirrels who loved the smell of the smoke of a campfire. coming down from a tree and floating through the smoke down to the base of another tree. And then they'd run up their tree and they'd fly back and down again. A beautiful sight. They were such pretty little animals.
I missed India terribly. I think really you always do. I don't think we ever really get it out of your system.
It grows on you. It becomes part of your life. I correspond with lots of people still. But going back again, I don't think I want to see it anymore now. It all makes me too sad.
They came home, philosophically, at the end, to live among people who knew little about their lives and understood less. But they'd often gone out, romantically enough, on what male India unromantically labelled the fishing fleet.
I have a great friend, and she and I went out together. And we had a whale of a time, because both our fathers were stationed in Lucknow, and we were the only two girls in the place. So you can imagine, we had rather a good time.
And when I got to Bombay, I had a very gay life, like all young girls, on the marriage market. And we used to go to the races, we used to go to balls, we used to go to dances at Government House. And of course, we had to dress in a very conservative manner because you had to wear long white gloves and nearly always had a sort of taffeta parasol. It was all very conventional. There was a very strict morality. I think men rather demanded it. After all, you were looking for a husband. And so you knew where to sort of draw the line.
Yes, of course it went to our heads, all this adulation. One counted scalps like, I don't know what, really. But nevertheless, we always realized it was a superficial fun. But we saw, when we went to Kashmir, we went on a trek in the Himalayas. And we climbed up to 16,000 feet, and we lived in our bedding rails again. It was India as we learnt to love it.
But of course, not all the Memsahibs came to India for the first time in the fishing fleet. Many of them already had India in their families, in their childhood, and in the blood.
Oh, India then, all through the time I was at school and growing up, was a land of promise, something I would go back to.
As far as the women were concerned in India, I always thought they were of two kinds. There was the wife of the political service, whose life was India, the wife of the Indian army, again, whose life was India, ones like myself whose husbands were British service, whose life was short time here, short time there. Home. You could make of it what you liked, two things. There were the ones who lived a life more English than the English. Or the other kind, I'm afraid I belong to, who realized my time was short there, and I must get everything I could from it. I learned as much as I could of the language. I got to know my household as people and not as household stock. I myself was born in Malaya and had that sort of background. Taking an interest in different parts of the world. Ones who were more English, perhaps, than at home, they tended to live at the club, to play bridge, to swim. But I think the real India passed them by, and I think a lot of it was probably loneliness. They missed home, they missed the security of an English background.
I think India was a much easier country for a man than a woman. They are so often accused, the Memsahibs, of being idle, frivolous and selfish. But take a girl from a background which has had no connection with India at all, to whom it's a totally strange country. And it is a frightening country, unless you were at home with it. I think India frightened people, especially women. They'd been told you caught awful diseases, and they imagined that you caught a disease from practically anybody. I don't mean the most sinister form of disease, but things like smallpox and so on. And also they were told about snakes and tigers and things, which you don't really need to be too worried about in India. And They were frightened and also lonely.
When we were in Kontai, we were very near the sea, and I used to get awful nightmares that the wall, which divided the sea from the lowland, would one day burst and flood the whole area and our house. This was the most extraordinary nightmare, this huge wave following. And then I used to roam about in the large compound, and I found the remnants of a grave under a banyan tree, and found that it was a former SDO's subdivisional officer's wife who had died there with typhoid in the first flood, when this tidal wave had swept the whole of this area and no one could get to her, and she had died before she could get any medical attention. And I had found her grave hidden amongst rubbish under this banyan tree. And so I had a stone erected and a little inscription.
A very great friend of mine had servants that I knew by name, knew them very well, and he went off and left his wife in a rioting time to go up and deal with a rioting situation higher up in Bengal. And having settled that, came back to his house, having left his wife in the care of his servants, and called for her as he went through the compound gates with no reply, no servants were visible, walked into his bungalow and found his wife's head on a plate on the kitchen table. Now, this is a very exceptional case, if you like, but it is the fact that much as one did really love one's servants, in the end you knew such stories and you knew that these things could happen, and therefore much more horrific than if you didn't trust your servant and simply ordered them about.
And of course some women were simply overwhelmed, as finally and effortlessly by India, as had been Lady Griffith's sister Memsahib, whose very grave was vanishing under rubbish.
She just died, you know. She hated everything about India. She didn't like the servants, and she didn't like the weather, didn't like the food, and she didn't like the people. She didn't ride, and she wouldn't learn to ride, and she just grumbled all day long, do you see, and hated everything. And then one day, the doctor told me that she was ill, and so I said, oh, what's wrong with her? He said, oh, I don't know. And the next day, she was dead. It was so very sad, though. I felt sad for
her. A surprising number of these girls managed, despite the vastness and loneliness, to look Mother India straight in the eye. But even if they found the strength not to let India overwhelm them, that didn't mean that she would treat them gently.
I met my husband in Karachi, and we got married, and the next day we were sent off to this place called Mirpakas in Sindh, which was very hot, and the floods and cholera and malaria. It had sandflies, mosquitoes, very lonely. I was rather miserable, really. I was chewed up most of the time. And I got malaria. And I didn't think that Sindh was really a very nice place for a woman to live in.
Everything gets dried up with an intense heat, and the roof is made of sort of bamboo poles, and they shrink, so they're sort of gaps, and through the gaps, when the monsoon comes, it simply crashes in the rain. It's like living under a waterfall. My husband and I went to bed holding up umbrellas the first day of the monsoon.
But if they could take it, India did begin, usually, to grow on them.
I found India a country of great sensual pleasure. It penetrated all one's senses, scent particularly. There were so many unpleasant smells in India, but there were so many lovely smells. And I've only got to shut my eyes and picture an evening in a village in India with the smell of wood smoke, which of course is the most gorgeous smell in the world, and it's the mist used to rise up from the fields. The very sudden twilight in India always. And when the twilight came, it was dark, and the mist would rise up in a sort of blue haze from the field, and there would be this gorgeous smell drifting across the fields.
For myself, riding was one of the chief things in my life in India. The sheer fact of having a good horse and riding for miles across country, riding out into the fields, into the paddy fields. Up in the north, you rode through miles of mustard fields or beans with the most wonderful scent. You'd meet peacocks strutting about, you'd go through the villages, and all the people were very friendly. They'd offer you a glass of milk or some fruit. They'd chat, and I usually rode completely alone.
And then if you rode through a village, the dogs would all rush out and bark and scream round your opponent's legs and crack a whip at them, and they run away. And sometimes the villagers you'd meet out in the blue, they'd come out and accept you. I mean, I must have looked very peculiar, a white woman with a pith helmet on a big black pony. And they'd come out and put their hands together and say, Ram, Ram, and you'd say, Ram, Ram. And then I'd say, Ram, Ram, to the shrines as I went past. It was the most beautiful country when we rode for miles on it. Very lonely.
My husband's regiment happened to be one of the best polo playing regiments in the Indian Cavalry. I was never a great horseman. I hunted with the Peshawar Vale hounds, more faint than pursuing, because the ditches were really quite terrific.
When we had to move from one camp to another, I very often had to go on an elephant with the baby and the ayah and the cook and the bearer. And we used to sit back to back, very comfortable on the elephant. And we used to have our orange juice and our morning tea. And the elephant used to kneel down, and the bearer used to take the baby and let him go into the jungle. And I used to have the baby on my lap. Or sometimes the mahout would have the baby sitting in front on the elephant's head. And the elephant was very kind to us. When it was getting warm, it would fill its trunk and spray us with water to keep us cool. And if we were eating an orange, it would put its trunk back and take the orange and eat it, take it away from us. The elephants were very tame, and we were all very fond of them. And the children used to just run between the elephant's legs. It would stand there, and my little boy would pull his bricks underneath the elephant, and nobody ever worried. And I used to sit leaning up against the elephant's leg.
During this trek through Ladakh on the borders of Tibet, you are camping between 14,000, 15,000 and 16,000 feet at your various camps. You march anything from 15 to 25 miles a day. And up there, your only fuel was the dung from yachts. And you all pick up bits of dried dung, and on that you cook your supper. And as there was no fuel of yacht dung further up, my husband nobly collected all the sheep's dung he could find. And as we shot a goose, I roasted my goose on sheep's dung. A thing that I'd be very proud of, because you need a tremendous amount. It glows very nicely, but it's not nearly so hot or so consistent as yachtstown.
But however much you loved the hills or were touched by the devotion of your bearer, India remained an awe-inspiring presence. The Memsahib could feel it in the air. Some of her frivolities and pettinesses were frail defences against it.
Everything's sudden in India. The sudden twilight, sudden death. A man can be talking to you at breakfast and be dead in the afternoon. Like that.
Life was so very short. If anybody got ill and died, it was finished. They were buried the same day.
Delhi is so saturated with history, with a great deal of violence and sorrow, but also heroic deeds.
that if you're sensitive at all to that sort of thing, you can't move about there without feeling it pressing in upon you. These things, however laughable it may seem to the most rational, are very much more present in India than in this country. There's absolutely no question about that, that the unseen world is in some way better understood by Eastern religions and accepted quite calmly, without fuss, and also is more apparent to anybody who is in any way sensitive to it.
I was given a room in this house, which from the very moment I took it over, I disliked and felt that there was something evil there. But eventually I persuaded my mother to let me leave this room. About 6 months later, I was chatting to my mother's Aya, whom I was very fond of, and I just said to her, quite by chance, Aya, did you ever feel anything funny about my room in Mount Arbor? And she looked rather coy, and she said, well, I don't like to say anything to you, because I think the lady staff will be angry. My mother, having said this is all schoolgirl nonsense, but she said, well, when I used to go up to turn down your bed in the evening, I felt that there was something evil in this room. I felt so strong that one day I asked the old chokidar, this is the caretaker of the house who stayed there the whole year round, I asked him whether there was something funny about the Miss Saab's room. And he told me that in 1913, a young Mem Saab had died in that room, and that ever since then, her ghost had walked there, and that in the winter months when the house was empty, he had seen this Mem Saab walking about this room, her root had hid it. Years later, I found out from the church register who the woman was who had died there, and sure enough, she was the young wife of a British officer. And I went to her grave in the churchyard, and I stood by this grave, and I said to her, you gave me a very bad summer.
Mem Saab's sheet anchor was some kind of replica of her domestic world at home. It was a replica with considerable contrasts.
During the first year of my married life, I was rather horrified to find my husband lived on the country. Only chapatis and homemade porridge or ground wheat ground on stones and therefore full of stones. Chicken and rice. And no biscuits, except a ship's biscuit, which he seemed very fond of and I found extremely difficult to swallow.
The protocol, when you were giving a big dinner party, you always consulted what I call the Blue Book. That was the civil list. And you had to do this most carefully because they all had a definite precedence, one of the other. I have seen irate Mem Saabs be extremely annoyed if they thought they were put in their wrong places at a dinner party.
And you were taken into dinner by the host, and the hostess would have the senior man on her right. Very formal. I mean, it was very carefully arranged beforehand, the table, and everyone had their names printed. Sometimes if you went to other people's dinner parties, you were surprised to find your own dishes being used, and sometimes even your own vegetables you recognize, because there was a lot of borrowing and good feeding between the servants, and if they felt they hadn't got enough, they would just borrow from their next door neighbors.
When I first went to the mountains, I'd never used either a shotgun or a rifle, and my husband said I must learn to shoot. Well, this was very necessary because often we couldn't get either a sheep or a goat to kill, and so I'd go out anywhere in the jungle and shoot some green pigeon or something for supper, something to fill the pot or a pheasant or something.
I remember being very nervous when I first went out to India as a conversation. And my mother said, well, you must make it. You must talk first to the man on your right and then you must talk to the one on your left. And you must talk. You must never say something that completely shuts up the efforts of the man on your right or left. And that became quite fun after time. Everyone really very nice. It was quite easy. And then, finally, at the end of dinner, the ladies would all go into the drawing room, leaving the men with their cigars and their port. And then about half an hour later, they'd be joined by the men, and one would carry on fairly formal conversation, I suppose, until 10:30, which was the magic hour in which the senior lady had to then get up and say, well, she must go home now. And until she'd done that, no one could move.
The Memsahib has often been criticized for keeping herself aloof from Indian women. But Indian society itself and the structure of the Raj didn't make it easy to mix.
Seeing women dancing, smoking, drinking, something was quite foreign to our culture or our tradition. To the average Indian, shocking. To the westernized Indian, something that he ought to do himself and teach his wife to do.
Indian women didn't come into society at all. You see, they were nearly all in purdah. It was very rare in my day for an Indian woman to be out of purdah. And so your chances of meeting them were fairly rare.
There were few and far between Indian ladies who themselves were well-educated. And many instances of such Indian ladies having very good friends among British women. And the relations between their husbands were not so close as between these women. But such examples are very rare. I'm talking of the earlier times. Well, later on, the picture was very different.
The peasant people, especially the women of India, no matter whether they were in the hills or the plains, I had the greatest love for. I have never seen such courage. It didn't matter how poor they were. They would always ask you to share their bed, to share their home, to share their last bit of food or milk.
Well, I was lucky that I had a few very good friends. But by and large, I should think that, you know, British women never cared to know the Indians very much.
I think there were certain attitudes which you took up perhaps from all the others, such as you don't mingle with Indians too much. You remember that you're British, but you may or may not have fitted into it inside yourself. I have a cousin who lived in India the whole of the time, she and her husband, the way they would have lived in England. He was a bridge engineer, and they went about on bicycles. They used to go under the trees and read poetry, and they never played any games or did any of those sort of things. Oh, yes, you could be an eccentric. Once you were accepted, oh, she's an eccentric, then you could do anything, really, like you can here. But it was rather the older woman would get together with you and say, you know, you won't do your husband any good, dear, by going and doing those sort of things. And so if you were a good little wife, you probably thought, well, I better not do that.
One of the greatest heartaches of the Raj was separation.
It was an awful wrench to leave some poor little mite at school and go back to India. It really was.
When my first son arrived, I looked at him and I thought, oh dear, you will soon be 5 or 6. Then I shall have to take you home and leave you there.
My husband and I were always separated. We were stationed in Peshawar, we were stationed in Banu, back again to Peshawar, back again to Dar es Salaam. And all that time my husband was serving on the frontier at stations where wives were not allowed to go. I once worked out that in 13 years we'd only spent 3 whole years together.
Separation was the ground base of one of Kipling's most famous themes. Flirtation and adultery in the hill stations where wives and children were sent when the vast plains became unbearable in the hot weather season.
Simla looked out over the Himalayas and they seemed to stretch for millions of miles. And I do remember lying in bed and getting a feeling of floating out of the window over these mountains, this feeling of mountains of floating of mystery, really. I have never seen anything that even dimly compares with the range of the Himalayas. And Simla was 8,000 feet. It was plastered against the side of one of the lower ranges of the Himalayas. And you came up and found yourself on these ledges, one ledge above the other, nothing but narrow paths everywhere, and these appalling drops. And if you take a community and jam them onto this series of ledges at 8,000 feet, you will get a claustrophobic and enclosed society.
I used to always go back to wherever we were once the monsoon had started, because however lovely those hill stations were, only they became boring after a few months, you know, they rarely did.
There were a few liaisons, but they were generally between married women who were up there without their husbands and some young officer that she had fallen in with for the season. But we were still really very much brought up in an atmosphere of innocence and strong sort of Edwardian morality. If a young officer wanted a bit of fun, he would pay court to a married woman, not to a girl.
The subalterns told me that as we go up, we're fighting rearguard actions against the husbands who are coming down. They had their gay time, do you see?
And then if you were getting on very nicely and having a splendid affair with some splendid young man, what did happen was exactly what Kipling describes, that he was sometimes pinched for one by glamorous married women. Because the married women had a much better time than the girls in those days. So it was the last remnant of the Kipling business. I was certainly never allowed to go out with a young man alone. Always had to be in a party. And it was supposed to be a party with one married woman at least in it. Even though she might be only a few years older than oneself, and probably very promiscuous, or certainly not terribly moral virtues, so it didn't matter a bit, provided she was married. The married women had an edge on one because they could go out alone with a man and they could give parties as they pleased. And they did very often pinch the most attractive young men against whom one had no defense.
Great preparation. When there was going to be a dance, there was great preparation. All the youngest subalterns at once used to rush round and borrow things like curtains and heavens knows what else, and to make what they called kala juggas. Kala means black, and jugga means a place, a black, you know, a dark place. They all used to, these subalterns used to have their own kala juggas, to which they used to take their pet partners, and no one else would be allowed to go there. Oh, it was a great thing, the kala juggas and the dancers.
I remember in Gulmerg, there was a wonderful kala jugga up in some loft above the clubhouse, and you climbed up a ladder, and there were many couples up there. You walked to your place over the feet of several recumbent other couples. But, of course, we hadn't got the permissive society then. And although you might indulge in quite heavy petting, I don't think any young girls went beyond that point. I don't say that the wives didn't. It was excessively gay. My record was 26 nights dancing and running, at the end of which I could hardly keep awake, but had to attend an official dinner that my mother was giving, and was very reprimanded for falling asleep in the middle when talking to a very woolly old judge. I remembered his droning voice and falling off asleep on the sofa beside him when I was supposed to be doing my bit in entertaining. I don't think that one felt one was on show or in a goldfish bowl. You see, don't forget, part of the menial attitude towards servants was that they didn't exist. I mean, if a servant saw you in bed with somebody else, it was immaterial. He was nobody. There's an extraordinary attitude. I don't say that they ever did see, because, I mean, you wouldn't be so indiscreet as that, but I don't think it was felt that English women had to be above criticism. It was, you mustn't be found out.
Of course, I mean, that was always true, but all this sort of thing went on in India, all over India, the whole time, just as Kipling describes.
Coming home from dances, very often the current boyfriend used to walk by the side of the rickshaw, murmuring sweet nothings and holding hands over the side of the hood, but nothing much more than that. But it was very romantic. It's difficult to convey how enormously romantic the atmosphere was, not only in Simla, but also in Delhi or in the plains. But India is very conducive to romance in the old-fashioned term. Not to promiscuous sex so much as romance. Of course, scenery is fantastic. And then these warm, starlit nights and bright, huge moon. And in Simla especially, these towering hills and mountains stretching away, silence and strange exotic smells coming out of side alleys. The slowness of the pace, everything, was intensely romantic. Then I think a lot of people were lonely.
Loneliness, romance, and protocol. The hand that shot the tiger wore long evening gloves.
Suddenly, I just felt the tree. As it were, dip. I couldn't believe it. Something shook the tree. So I cast my eyes down, and there was the panther sitting right under my knees. I couldn't do a thing. I couldn't move. I couldn't get my rifle. All I could see was those whiskers twitching. To and fro, the mouth twitching, the eyes glaring, looking to and fro to see what was around. Every hair on its body. And I just prayed that there'd be a shot under my legs and my husband would shoot me. Anyhow, I just froze. Suddenly he decided he just jumped down in front and he went very slowly to his kill. I was still absolutely frozen. When he got to the hindquarters, he looked all the way round and he looked absolutely directly back at me. And I thought he'd see me. So then I got my hand through out of my Macintosh, and I raised my sights, and I thought, well, I must kill and not wound. So I took a neck shot and fired. And with two or three bounds, he was away. And a voice from my husband said, "You've missed him, you've missed him." I stood up in my funny little tree, saw him trying to get up a bank, and he just fell back on his back, stone dead. I got down from that tree, of course, white as a sheet.
I went to the theatre. Somebody said, "Have you got any white gloves?" And I said, "Long white gloves." And I said, "No, I have no long white gloves." They said, "But you must have long white gloves. Of course, the Viceroy is going." So I borrowed white gloves and went out to dinner with another very exalted old dear who was performing on the party we were in. And we had arrived at her household, and she was a wonderful old lady. Her husband was a very senior army officer. And I tried not to look too startled to find her very dignified bearer on his knees on the floor, solemnly using a fit spray up the old darling's petticoats. She looked at me and said, "Quite all right, my dear, quite all right. I find this is very efficacious for the mosquitoes."
The life of the Mensahib was poised on the knife edge of that kind of common sense between romantic femininity and the general toughness required of all those who lived in the Raj.
And one used to ride out to lunch and to race meetings in one's best dress, hitched round one's waist with a blanket tied round you and a big floppy hat.
Ride to the club in our evening dress, tied up round our waist. We would get off our ponies, let down the dress to its full length, and meantime, of course, the pony men had to keep waiting, probably out in the rain, holding our ponies till 2 or 3 in the morning when we left the dance and got back onto our ponies and rode back to our various destinations again.
From start to finish, India was always testing the Memsahib, flattering her into arrogance, tempting her with loneliness, stunning her with heat, threatening the love of her separated children, boring her into pettiness, or turning suddenly lethal with riot or cholera. The majority of Memsahibs, who nonetheless loved India, did so with a passion free from sentimental illusion.
Of course, there was a very strong feeling in India, I think perhaps not only in India, that women were not supposed to be clever. They were supposed to be decorative and intelligent and good listeners and all that sort of thing, but they weren't really supposed to be clever. And if, by any conceivable chance, anybody was clever, they kept it pretty dark. But then you've got to remember that India was a very extrovert country. We were always doing things.
Oh, the English woman, the Memsahib, in many ways, she loved India. Sometimes I think she might have been afraid, but I love the women, I love the babies. I've eaten more hard-boiled eggs that are black where they've had their dirty fingers, but I never said no. I was friendly with them. Oh, I think the English woman trusted her ayah, and she trusted her bearer. And when I lay awake at night and think of those people I lived with, I worked with, the Anglo-Indians as well, they taught me a lot, and the bearers and the faithfulness of even my sweeper, I think he's a better man sometimes than a Britisher.
I feel that even those British people who felt so completely at home in India, I still don't feel that we can ever claim to have completely integrated with Indian life and Indian thought. And I don't think that that is what we were intended to do. I feel that we went and did a certain job, and that none of the wisest people who've ever written or thought about India have ever claimed that we were meant to be there forever. I also have a very strong feeling that you must never take land away from people. People's land has a mystique, and you must not take their land. You can go and possibly order them about for a bit and introduce some new ideas and possibly dragoon an alien race into attitudes that are not quite familiar to them. But you must then go away and die in Cheltenham. You must not take away the land and stay there.
When I brought my two children home, I was taking them from Plymouth to Cornwall, where I'd rented a cottage, and we got into the train, and the younger one, aged 5, piped up in front of a carriage full of people, "Mummy, why hasn't the guard come along and asked your permission if he can stop the train?" So I replied, "Darling, we are not in Daddy's district now, and they do not come along and ask me if they may stop the train. This is England. You must get used to English customs now."
In the third of Plain Tales from the Raj, the chief speakers were Lady Smythe, Mrs. A.P.S. Hamilton, Mrs. G.N. Wood, Mrs. C.M. Bowder, Lady Griffiths, Lady Dring, Mrs. David Symington, Mrs. Iris Portal, Lady Lawrence, Lady Foster, Lady Caulfield, Vere Lady Birdwood, Mrs. R.V. Vernade, Mrs. Lakshmi Mazumdar, and Colonel B.H. Saidi. The presenter was Evan Charlton. The field recordings were by Charles Allen and Prakash Mirchandani, and the program was composed and produced by Michael Mason.